This is Ronald Coleman, inviting you to radio's most dramatic half hour, Favorite Stories. Days of airplanes shattering speed records, racing on ahead of the sound of their own engines. We can travel almost anywhere in a matter of hours. But however fast we go, we never quite reach tomorrow. Tomorrow is always a day ahead of us. This seemed to vex Mr. H.G. Wells, so he wrote a story about a man who invented the sort of radioactive motorcycle, which would travel to tomorrow and into the future beyond. He called it the Time Machine, and the old professor, Kay Kaiser, chose it as his favorite story. Here's Act One. I shall call him the Time Traveler, for that's surely the best name for him. Of course, he has a name like other men, but it doesn't suit him. For it's an ordinary name, and the Time Traveler is a most extraordinary man. I shall always treasure the evenings I've spent at the home of the Time Traveler. It's been his habit to invite three of us to dinner, perhaps once each fortnight. Famous London editor, a prominent artist, and myself as the representative of that world within our world, the theater. Conversing with the Time Traveler was like dueling with a great fencing master. We'd all sit about lazily before the fire and admire his earnestness and the brilliance of his imagination.
Oh, come now, old fellow. You don't expect us to go along with
that.
I know it. I refuse to believe it.
Now, just a moment, please. I beg you to bear with me on this concept.
Oh, you're a dreamer. And this is pure dream stuff you're giving us.
Perhaps we're all dreaming, gentlemen. Was it Voltaire who said, "Last night I dreamed I was a butterfly. But how do I know that I am not now a butterfly, dreaming that I'm a man?"
I believe that the things which are solid and which can be seen and felt exist.
You do? Tell me then, what qualities do you feel are necessary to prove a thing exists?
Well, there are only three dimensions, length, breadth, thickness.
I object. I ask you to imagine, gentlemen, a cube. A square box, let us say, which has only those three dimensions. Length, breadth, and thickness. Could you see it?
Of course. Why not?
Would not such a cube require another dimension?
Hmm?
It must also have duration.
Duration?
A cube or a box cannot exist instantaneously. It must last. It must have a fourth dimension, time. Anything in order to exist must have four dimensions, length, breadth, thickness, and duration. I've been working on a little invention.
Hardly new.
It isn't quite finished yet, but I think it may be ready for a demonstration, gentlemen. It's over here in my glass, please. Take a look at this, my friend. Not much larger than an ordinary alarm clock, you might say, but quite a remarkable little device.
Complicated. What is it?
This is a gadget for traveling along the dimension known as time.
What? Along the dimension of time?
Look at it this way, gentlemen. Thus far, we of the human race have only submitted to time. We've all drifted along with it together like a Huckleberry Finn floating down the Mississippi River on a raft. Time is very much like a river, you know. And suppose some very ingenious person, such as one of us, perhaps, should invent a machine which would travel upstream to the very headwaters of time itself, or race on ahead of the current to those parts of the time dimension which we call the future.
Oh, absurd. It's against all reason.
Shall I demonstrate?
With that gadget you have in your hand?
Pardon me, my friends, while I make some adjustments in the mechanism here. We might call this a time machine. Now observe. Here is one little white lever, and here is another.
It's beautifully made.
It took 2 years to complete. Now, I want you clearly to understand that this lever, being pressed over, sends the machine gliding into the future. And this other lever, so, reverses the motion. This saddle, in miniature, represents the seat of a time traveler. In a moment now, I shall press the lever, and off the machine will go. It will vanish, pass into future time, and disappear. Have a good look at the thing. Satisfy yourselves that there's no trickery.
There doesn't seem to be any trickery about it. No, everything seems perfectly legitimate and in order.
Very well, then. Watch.
The time traveler touched the little ivory lever on the machine. I'm sure not one eye blinked. Not one of us took his gaze off that fine clock-like mechanism resting on the library table. Slowly, the time traveler moved the lever. And there came a breath of wind. One of the candles on the mantel was blown out, and the little machine suddenly swung around, became indistinct, was seen as a ghost for a second perhaps. And it was gone. Vanished. Save for the lamp, the table was bare.
What happened?
Well, what do you make of it?
Are you trying to tell us that that machine has gone off into the future and it will never be seen again?
Since there's no one to press the other lever and reverse the motion, I predict that the machine will travel on indefinitely into the future. I have in my laboratory a nearly completed full-size time machine, which can carry a living human being within its field of motion.
A living being?
Yes. And very shortly, I expect to step into the saddle of this mechanism and go for a few 100,000-year spin into the future.
You're not serious.
I've almost finished work on a machine in which I intend to explore time. Is that plain? I was never more serious in my life. If you gentlemen would have the goodness to join me at dinner exactly 1 week from tonight, I may have some astounding experiences to tell you of my explorations in time.
Of course, the editor and the painter and I were at the home of the time traveler the following week. But there was no sign of our host, except a rather strange note which we found under the mantelpiece clock, asking us to begin dinner at 7 o'clock if, for any reason, he hadn't arrived. And so it was, we went to dinner without him. We were quite worried when, as we were finishing our dessert, our friend hadn't yet appeared. Then, I suddenly noticed that the door to the corridor outside the dining room was opening. Slowly, without noise. When the door opened wider, I saw the time traveler standing before us. His coat was dirty, his hair was mussed, and grayer, either with dust or because its color had actually faded. The face of our host was ghastly pale. For a moment he hesitated in the doorway, as if he'd been dazzled by the light. Then he came into the room, walking with a footsore limp.
Good heavens, Mitch. What's the matter?
What happened to you?
We started dinner, as you suggested.
I'm glad you did. Don't let me disturb you. I'm quite all right. I've had a rather grim experience. I feel strange.
Here, come on, sit down.
I'll be all right in a minute. Save me some of that mutton, will you? I'm starving for a bit of meat.
Can you tell us where you've been?
I don't mind telling you what has happened, but I can't argue. I'm too tired.
Very well. We won't interrupt you.
Well, I didn't get the time machine ready to operate until this morning. ask cook to bring me some more potatoes and gravy, will you, please?
Yes.
Really, I'm famished.
Now, please, tell us what happened.
Yes. It was about 10 o'clock when I climbed into the saddle of the completed time machine and moved the starting lever slowly forward. I seemed to realize. I felt a nightmare sensation of falling. The laboratory got hazy and went dark. The scrub woman came in to clean, a process which usually requires several hours of an evening. But to me, as I sat in my time machine, the scrub woman appeared to shoot across the room like a rocket. I pressed the lever to its extreme position. Day and night began to alternate faster and faster, like the flapping of a black wing. The laboratory wall suddenly fell away. I suppose the building had been destroyed and I was coming into the open air. The sun was spinning through the sky so swiftly that it seemed a brilliant arc hanging in space. And the moon, going through the various phases, a faintly fluctuating band. The landscape was misty and vague. I was speeding along the fourth dimension at such a rate that a century seemed less than a second of ordinary time. With an abrupt movement of my right hand, I pressed the lever which brings the time machine to a halt. I was thrown off the saddle of my conveyance into a dense fog. The sickening sense of time traveling had stopped. I looked at the dials of my machine, which informed me I was now in the year 802,701 A.D. Out of the twilight and fog in which I found myself, I perceived a human shape moving slowly toward me, a mere shadow in the mist. As it drew closer, it seemed more like a ghost than a human form. For its face, a shapeless, expressionless thing, was pale white, not unlike the color of vermin or the white underbelly of a large fish. It crouched over me and stared with pinkish eyes. I thought for a moment that the specter was about to leap upon me. It reached out with a watery forefinger and touched my cheek. I shrank away in horror, for the hand which touched me was as cold as ice.
Now we're ready for Act Two of Kay Kaiser's favorite story, The Time Machine, by H.G. Wells. As we sat around the dining room table that night, listening to the tale of the time traveler, it seemed almost that we were going through the experiences with him.
Weary from fright and fatigue, I lay down in the darkening twilight close beside my time machine and went to sleep on the fog-wet grass of the 8,000th century. When I awoke, everything was changed. It was bright morning. The mist had vanished. Only a few yards away, across the close-cropped lawn, stood a monument of some sort, a rather grim, sphinx-like thing of white marble. It was mounted at the top of a bronze pedestal.
Mama, I know.
Then I heard a sound like the pleasant laughter of children, and I saw little figures coming toward me out of the bushes. They were only 4 feet tall, graceful little creatures wearing purple tunics and leather sandals.
Eloy?
Hello. Hello. Eloy.
Who wants to, Eloy? Eloy, who wants to?
One of the little fellows was trying to ask me a question. Where did I come from? What could I tell him? I sought to demonstrate my coming by showing them my time machine.
I turned toward the place where I had left it on the grass. It was gone. The time machine was gone. Like a lash across the face came the possibility of losing my own age, of being left helpless in this strange new world. I leaped down the slope to where I had left the machine, and the little people scampered away in amazement. I thought it must be in the bushes. They've moved a little, that's all. But no, it was not there. Where is it? What have you done with my time machine?
Eloy?
I picked up one of the creatures by the scruff of his neck and I shook it. What have you done with it? Where is it? Where is my time machine? His face was flushed. I saw no comprehension there and nothing but confusion. I put down the pitiful little creature. Suddenly I saw in the grass the marks where the machine had been dragged up the slope to the bronze column surmounted by the white sphinx. There the marks on the grass stopped. So I concluded that the machine must be inside that greenish metal tube. It was made from plates riveted together. But I could find no doorway or latch whereby to enter the base of that pedestal. Yet I was certain that my time machine was there, and only a fraction of an inch of discolored bronze separated it from me. I had no tools. How could I reach the machine? How could I get it? How could I get back to my own century? Why? Why had they done this to me, and who? Who had done it? These whimpering, laughing child people who had danced about me? Impossible. Then I recalled the pale, ghostly creature I had seen on my arrival, and my blood ran cold. Suddenly, the humor of the situation came to my mind. The thought of the years I had spent in study and toil to get into this future age, and now my passionate anxiety to get out of it. I wandered about, observing the way of human life in this faraway time. I happened to pass a stream in which some of the little creatures were bathing. One of them, a little girl, was seized with a cramp and began to drift helplessly down the stream. I dived into the water and succeeded in rescuing the child. As soon as the little being got her breath, she threw her arms about my neck and covered me with kisses. I suppose this meant thank you in her simple language. Then she pointed to herself and said,
Weena. Weena.
Is that your name? Weena?
Eloy. Weena. Weena.
So it happened that Weena became my inseparable companion. She followed me about wherever I went, plucking flowers for me and laughing like a child. Then we chanced to come near an open well in the middle of a meadow. I had noticed hundreds of such wells in the neighborhood. Weena tugged at me to draw me away from the opening in the ground. I went to the edge of the well, and Weena became almost hysterical with terror.
No, no. More luck.
What are you trying to say, Weena? What are you trying to tell me?
More luck. More luck.
Morlock?
I...
What did Morlock mean? I looked down the well shaft and heard a humming, a thud, thud, thud of working machinery. I called down into the darkness.
Hello! Hello! Morlock!
It stopped. Plainly, there were creatures down there who had heard the word Morlock and shut off the throbbing machinery. Perhaps they had made off with my time machine. I noticed there were hooks fastened into the side of the well, forming a kind of ladder. I decided if I were ever to find my time machine, I must explore what lay down there in that throbbing darkness. Little Weena cried piteously and tried to draw me back, but I pushed her away and lowered myself down the throat of the well, hand over hand, into the gathering darkness. Down and down I went until the opening above my head seemed like a mere pinch point in the surrounding black. I was terribly cramped, and my arms ached as I lowered myself into nothingness. Then my feet struck a solid stone floor. The air was hot with a greasy smell of machinery. I could see nothing, but I had the ugly feeling of being watched.
I suspected that dozens, hundreds of eyes were peering at me out of the darkness, that they could see me, though I could not see them. I groped in my pocket for a box of safety matches. I was encircled by a ring of luminous eyes set in white, chinless faces. The flame of my match seemed to frighten them, and they backed away toward the shadowy masses of machinery that loomed behind them. The match burned my fingers and went out. I fumbled to strike another, and in my confusion, I dropped the box. I could feel the ring of creatures tightening about me in the darkness. Their chilled wet hands touched my arms, my face. They began to crawl over me, to pluck at my clothing. I screamed out, Warlock! Those icy hands clawed at me. I tried to beat them off. I go for the ladder, but they tore at my shoes, clung to my legs. Hand over hand, I threw myself up the well shaft. Once I lost my grip and nearly fell. But finally, I came near the blessed daylight, and my pursuer shrank back into that darkness. With a mighty effort, I hauled myself out of the well mouth and fell unconscious on the sweet-smelling grass.
When I awoke, little Lena was kissing my hands. I was weak and ill. As I gradually realized what had happened to civilization on our planet, the human race was divided into two species. One, driven underground, perhaps by some dread war, had forsaken the daylight altogether. And the other branch of the human race, the upper worlders, had refined themselves into uselessness. When I got back to the vicinity of the White Sphinx, I saw the bronze plates of the pedestal had been swung open, and there stood my time machine. I looked through the open doors into the chamber of the Sphinx, clambered into the saddle of my invention. But even as I did so, the bronze doors began to swing shut. It was a trap. The Morlock had let me slip away from them once, and now they were determined to catch and hold me. For what hideous purpose I dare not imagine. But I would escape from them along a dimension they did not dream of. The doors hung shut off the daylight. And I heard the mutterings of the Morlocks coming up immediately beneath me from their underground wells and tunnels. I reached my hand to the reverse lever of my time machine, the control which would whirl me back along the river of time to my own day. I jerked it. And again, that sickly, dizzying sensation of time traveling. Backward, century by century, millennium after millennium, to this night, to this dinner table, to this conclusion of my story.
I refuse to believe it.
Here, look at these. They're still in my pocket.
What strange blossoms.
Those are a few of the blossoms that little Weena thrust in my pocket. Close to a million years from now.
I've never seen such flowers.
Nor will you again. In your lifetime. Now I must get to bed. It'll be an exhausting day tomorrow.
Well, you're not going time traveling again?
Can I stop now? At the very threshold of discovery. Columbus made 4 voyages to the New World. And I shall explore the future until I find... What? The golden age. Mankind moves in a spiral upward. And I'm convinced that the particular year I chanced to visit was a time when that human spiral dipped down and men were more degraded than they have been or will be hence. And I intend to set my course across the gulf of time to the century when men shall be like gods in body, and in mind, and in soul.
The golden age.
I will find it if I must travel a million years, or a million million. I shall find what is in store for this old earth of ours before it falls back into the sun.
That was the last I, or anyone, saw our friend the time traveler. He vanished on his time machine some 3 years ago. And I'm beginning to fear that he will never return. It may be that he has lost his way among the centuries. Or it may be that he has found the golden age, when men shall walk like gods upon the earth. But I have for my comfort two strange flowers, brown and brittle now, a gift to my friend from a creature of the distant future. A mute reminder that even when mankind shall reach its lowest ebb, gratitude and mutual tenderness shall still survive in the human heart. You The Time Machine by the late H.G. Wells. I want to congratulate William Johnston for an exciting performance as the time traveler, and our compliments to Maestro Claude Sweeten for his World of the Future music. And if Kay Kaiser happens to be listening, we hope he enjoyed our production of his favorite story. Three wishes have served as the basis for a great many tales since the world began, but the most novel and striking of stories on this theme is The Monkey's Paw. That's our favorite story next week. We hope you'll be listening.